This episode of the Tabletop Submarine Podcast is produced by Cake Pie Games. Cake Pie Games, games that are a piece of cake to set up and easy as pie to teach.
Welcome to the Tabletop Submarine, where we dive a little bit deeper into why we love board games. Strap in and prepare for a deep sea adventure. Here are your hosts.
Voyagers, men and women and others of old, people who like to eat corn, people who don't like to eat corn, and people who live in Mexico every once in a while like Andrew does. Welcome to the Tabletop Submarine Podcast. It is so good to have you here. Now, why did I mention corn? Because I'm eating a taco salad because I just got in from work 10 minutes ago. Because my life, it is delicious. Taco salad is very good, and I love my wife for making it. But we're not here to talk about taco salad as much as I could talk about taco salad. We're here to talk about stories. And you are on the Tabletop Submarine Podcast, and I am your host, Josh. With me is my number two taco.
I'm Andrew, and somehow I'm okay with being the number two taco. But anyway, we have our special guest. It is Colton Thompson of Kinson Key Games, also known galactically as the creator of Galactic Cruise, or one of the three creators of Galactic Cruise. He has a Kickstarter coming out very shortly, if it's not already going on now, and I have no doubts he's going to hit it on day one. But please say hello, Colton.
Hey, it is great to be here. Speaking of that taco salad, we had some great corn in a cup. You guys ever had corn in a cup? It's like corn on the cob, but you know, you don't even have to eat it off the cob. It's just right there in the cup for you. It's great.
Yeah, in Mexico, we call that elote, and that's tasty goodness.
It is good, tasty goodness.
Wait, is it like corn and mayonnaise in a cup or something?
Yeah, but it's more than that. Like, don't sell it short here. It's corn and mayo.
I've had elotes.
And, you know, some...
It's spices and seasoning and usually sprinkling great. Some other stuff in there. You make it more fun depending on where you're at. Different locales do different things, yeah.
Yeah, we have a local place here that does, like... They just put... It's the... Oh, what is it? It's the... They put, like, the spicy sauce in the... It's like, you can't get regular fruit. You can get a little bit of regular fruit, but most of the fruit is like, and we made it spicy and salty. So it's a kind of some like authentic Mexican treats, and they do like elote in a cup, and it's so good.
What I've always wanted to do, just so we can, before we move on, but I want to talk about this. I always wanted to like make a elote, like get my corn on the cob with the mayonnaise, the mayonnaise and stuff all over it, like the Parmesan cheese, and then take like blue Takis and just roll it all in that. So you have like this giant blue deliciousness with like lime juice all over it. So you have this extra crunchy awesomeness. I mean, I could talk about how corn is amazing forever, but we're not here to talk about corn. Well, actually, would there be an elote bar on a Galactic Cruise ship is the question. Can I go on a Galactic Cruise and eat some elote?
Listen, I would love to see Ian O'Toole illustrate such a thing. Because, bless his heart, we made him illustrate all kinds of stuff. Like, has the man ever drawn melty pizza before? He has now. We made him do all kinds of stuff for Galactic Cruise. It was great.
Speaking of which, I love this slow rollout you've been doing. Like, every two or three days, there's like a new illustration getting dropped, and I get more and more excited about all the cool stuff going on. Yeah, you got space bumper cars, you've got like, you know, a shopping center, you got all sorts of fun stuff on there. My favorite is the wine tastings and alcohol spirits area. That's my personal favorite.
Oh, of course.
Absolutely. Well, we keep talking about this, but some of our listeners may not know what Galactic Cruise is.
Yeah, probably should
say. It's one of the most anticipated games of the year. If you go like all these other media people, like you got the Brothers Murph, I know the Dice Tower, and all these people who have a much broader reach than us, this is one of their most anticipated games. So can you tell us, what is Galactic Cruise, and who is this trio of designers that seemingly came out of nowhere and are producing possibly one of the biggest hits of the year?
Yep.
Yeah, so Galactic Cruise is a 1-4 player competitive Euro-style worker placement game where you are helping to run the first company to offer extended stay space vacations. So imagine taking like a Carnival cruise or, you know, Caribbean mm-hmm. cruise, but instead of going out on the ocean, you're going up into space. So it has a lot of the trappings of your traditional cruise, but we get to have a lot of fun with it, you know, because of the gravity and the science or yep. the lack thereof. And we actually
and
went
planets.
With this. Yeah. We went with this like retro future vibe where it's like the science mm-hmm. didn't have to make sense. It's like you have mm-hmm. some segments where people are like floating and some where they're not floating and things that are scientifically impossible. But like if the Jetsons can do it, we can do it. But yeah, the game is worker placement and you have, you know, resource management. You have some Tableau building with your shuttles. Kind of a hodgepodge love letter to like all the stuff that we love in games that we then actually tied to the theme. So rather than just like pushing cubes, you're actually doing stuff that makes sense, we think. And other people have said they also think so. So I'm inclined to believe them.
Yeah. As a person who has playtested this more than a couple times, I can attest to you were doing all those things. But I think the game is really brilliant because it's more than just a hodgepodge of those things. You're doing some interesting twists on those things. Like there's some true innovation that's going on there, and I deeply appreciate that. Some of the worker placement aspects with the upgrading of spots and the bumping of people and different things pushing around. And then you have a reputation track, which can boost things or knock things down. There's some really cool aspects there, which I can't get into the nitty gritty with the, you know, it's a podcast, it's sound only. But I would highly recommend anybody who's listening to this, go check that out. At the very least, watch a video of how to play or how it works or something like that, because it really, I think, will surprise you. I think it has the depth of a Lacerda game, but I also think it's a little more accessible than most of his stuff. I really do feel like there's a common sense approach to how you play it that doesn't make it seem as complicated once you get through the teach.
Yeah, and that was kind of our goal there, right? We, TK especially, to go back to something that Josh asked earlier, I co-designed this game with TK King and Dennis Northcott. And oddly enough, the three of us are not identical in our gaming taste. But we all do appreciate Lacerda, and TK loves Vital Lacerda. But that's a very big barrier of entry, right, to get into Lacerda games. So we did kind of want to, for Galactic Cruise, design toward that weight class, but then, you know, ramp up the accessibility there. So we've had a lot of people say, oh, it's like a Lacerda light, or it's a, you know, if you've been scared of Lacerdas, this can be your stepping stone, which I think is exactly where we wanted to be with it. So it's always great to hear that, because that's kind of what the vision was take where Lacerda is, come in maybe one notch below in complexity without sacrificing any of the like great thematic mechanical stuff that he does in his games.
And I think you really did do that. I mean, I myself am more of a medium to light gamer. That's what I like to play. It's what I have time to play. That's what I like designing, is those kind of games. And I love playing Galactic Cruise because it's super strategic and it is complex. There's lots of things going on, but nothing seems out of place, and nothing seems extraneous, which is my problem with a lot of complex games. Sometimes they feel extraneous. Like, why is that there? Mm-hmm. Like, this could have been a card, mm-hmm. but everything in Galactic Cruise feels like it has a place. I understand everything just the way it's laid out. And it's one of my favorite stories because you and TK, Colton and Dennis, we all kind of came in at the same time to this whole designing hobby. And I've been able to gladly follow along on your guys' journey, you guys' build mm-hmm. up to when Galactic Cruise had like dice and all sorts of different things going on with it.
With the crazy stuff.
Yeah, it was just been so cool to see this game like go into its infancy to where it is now, a fully fledged Ian O'Toole illustrated game. And we have an episode of the Periscope where I'm going to be talking with TK and Dennis more about specifically the game, and more get into more than nitty gritty of it. But we are here kind of just to talk about you and talk about stories and gaming in general.
Yeah.
But if you want to leave, well, let's have one more chance. So if you want to leave anything about either Kintsugi or Galactic Cruise, what do you want to leave our listeners with really quick before we jump into the other stuff we have planned?
Yeah. So, I mean, for anyone that wants to follow along, see what we're about, the game is Galactic Cruise. The company is Kintsugi Games. And we are on most social media platforms, though Facebook, Instagram, Discord are kind of the ones that we are most frequently on. And there's also a Board Game Geek page for the game as well, where we try to keep it alive. We try to post something in there at least a few times a week, whether it's a image or a new forum. So we're trying to keep the community alive there. But yeah, enough about me. Let's just talk about stuff. Let's talk about games. Let's talk about the stuff that we love.
Let's talk about games. Let's go in the pre-launch. Talk about games we played recently.
The pre-launch. Get to know us and our guest.
In the pre-launch, we talk about one game we played recently and what we thought about it. And I'm going to throw this over to you, Andrew, and talk about a game I've never heard about before, ever. It sounds like a delicious cereal.
So this is Trails of Tucana, which is a route-building flip and right, I guess is what it is. This is a game that came out. It has a beautiful cover of a map being drawn with a big old toucan. But this was actually introduced to me by Michael Gugliano from 3WS. He put it on one of his shows on This Is the Play, which is part of the Full 42. Anyway, he played it on there, and we could play along, and you can print off the sheet from the publisher on BGG, and you can play along with it. So I did. I have now played it 4 times in 3 days. I find this to be a very relaxing but yet crunchy little roll and write. It does not have, you know, Motor City or Hadrian's Wall depth. It is nothing like that. I would put it to a little bit easier than Hexplorers, and I'd maybe a little lighter than, say, Welcome To, but very accessible. Like, it's just anybody, and very relaxing. Essentially, what you do is you're flipping over 2 cards that have 2 different types of terrain on them, and then you literally draw between those 2 pieces of terrain somewhere on your map, and you're trying to create routes to icons as well as to the villages around the outside. It is as simple as that. It's a 15-minute game, but I'm impressed. I like it quite a bit. Josh, what have you been playing?
Well, I want to follow up on that really quick. Sir, I'm going to press you a little bit. Compared to like other print and play one sheet games you have, how does this compare to things we did Postmarks, Voyages, and stuff like that? Is this one of the better one sheet games you've played, or is it like just do a little more? Like, how is it compared to other things you've played in that genre?
Sure. So, I mean, I like it currently more than I like Welcome To, but it's not drastically that way. I think Voyages is still the gold standard. I really like that one quite a bit. Yeah, I would think it's lighter than Three Sisters. It's lighter than Motor City. It's lighter than French Quarter. It's not that heavy, but it's also something that I think you can introduce to almost anybody. In fact, this is the kind of game I think I could take on vacation and play by the side of the pool if it's laminated.
Well, since you threw it to me, I will take it. I've been playing Junk Drawer, which is a game by Windsmith Games, but also by, I think it's distributed by 25th Century, so by Chad's company. I say his first name basis, like it's so weird. Like, I don't know why I said that. But I do know Chad more personally now. I met him at TantraCon, got more conversation with him now.
Right.
If you're listening, hi, Chad. Good to have you on the show listening to us. Anyways, I played Junk Drawer, and this is something we played at TantraCon, and we talked about it more on our TantraCon episode, but I wanted to bring it up again today because I've been playing a lot more. And I gotta say, I still absolutely love this game.
Yeah.
This is a fantastic game where you are organizing a junk drawer, so you have a bunch of polyomino shapes that everyone has the same set. And you have a board in front of you that has 4 different scoring sections. And on your turn, at the start of each round, there's a deck of cards in the center. You'll flip the top one. Everyone looks at what polyomino or piece of junk that is and places it in one of the quadrants on their board. They flip another card. They place it in one of the 3 remaining quadrants. two remaining quadrants for the next card, and then they finally place the last card on their remaining quadrant, the last little piece.
Mm-hmm.
And scoring is different each time because there's a bunch of different scoring section cards that you place on the center board that tells you how to score stuff. But I've been playing it so much that my wife loves it. I've played it at game meetups I've set up, and people love it there.
Yep.
And I'm happy to say that at K-Town, which are you guys going to be at K-Town, Kinsinkee, Colton, and Knoxville?
Yes. Yeah, we're actually one of the sponsors of it this year.
So I don't know if I tell this to you, Andrew, but Tabletop Submarine is a special media guest for K-Town.
Woohoo!
And I was invited actually through the Level Up Board Game podcast as one of their hosts. But then I reached out to them and saying, hey, what can I do as far as this Game of the Hour stuff, which I'll get to in a minute. But then he saw like, oh, you're part of Tabletop Submarine. Do you want to be a special guest for that as well? I'm like, heck yeah, we'll get our podcast out there too. But in return for getting basically a free badge, we had to host a Game of the Hour, which is basically for an hour, we sit down six copies of a game and we teach it. And I thought Junk Drawer was a great, it was a great choice for this. And so yeah. I reached out to Winsmith Games and said, hey, do you have six copies you're not going to use that I can borrow, basically? And they're like, yeah, sure, we got it. And we're talking now, and hopefully we'll have them on the show here soon.
Yeah,
and we're working with them because they want to know more about what we do. So that's Junk Drawer. It's opening up some more doors for us here on the show, and I'm excited to show more people this game because I really did feel like, it came out last year and it just flew underneath the radar, smaller publisher, but man, is it a great game.
Yeah, this is actually one of my favorites in the Polyomino for accessibility. This one has that weight of like Azul or Ticket to Ride. It's very accessible. Anybody can play, but there's a nice little crunchiness there, and there's a lot of replayability with each of the quadrants having different scoring mechanisms, and those can change every game. It's really cool. I'm really impressed by this one.
Colton, what have you been playing recently?
So it's actually even set up right here next to me. I just keep it set up good. Anymore now on my desk. And that is Clask.
Yes.
Clask is so interesting to me. It is a classic. Absolutely. Also, did you know that if you want a Clask tattoo, that they will pay for it? You never have to pay for Clask tattoos. The publisher will cover your Clask tattoo. So,
I'm not. You guys want to get matching ones? That's cool.
What's so interesting about it? So, for people that don't know Clask, it is essentially air hockey, but you play it with a magnetized little joystick that you control under the board. So you have like your little top paddle or like your top little hitter guy, whatever these things are called, is up top, knocking a ball around. You're trying to get into the opponent's hole, but you're controlling it from underneath the board. So it's on this like raised board. And I was looking into it. Apparently the guy that designed it, like for the longest, like handmade these in his garage and was just selling mm-hmm. them as like, I guess, novelty items. And now it, it really took off. It got, I think, nominated or recommended for the
Mensa. Was it Spiel? Mensa or something? But Spiel.
It got several things. Yeah. So it got a Spiel recommended back in 2017, but it's just so great. I think what's great about it is that it almost exists outside of what we even consider board games. Because mm-hmm. the three people I've played it with the most are my 4-year-old daughter, my mother. We played a lot of games growing up, but she is not a hobby gamer. And TK King, the heaviest gamer that I know. Like, those are the three people I've played this game with the most. And they all love it. And they're all like TK was over here the other day. We were doing some like business stuff. And we were waiting for something to load on a computer. And he was like, you want to play Clask while it loads? And it was just, it's neat because it really is one of those where it's like, you don't even teach it to people. You just set it up and people are like, I bet I know how to play this.
There are very few games that have an intrinsic understanding of the rules just by looking at it. That's one of them. And I would actually classify this as probably the second best entry-level dexterity game that exists, like really and truly. It's Crokinole first, and then Clask is second, as far as I'm concerned. A lot of people will probably say the other way around, but I think they're kind of both in that same level, and both are great.
Yeah, so that's been a lot of fun, and it's kind of it's different. I feel like it's different from everybody. Like it's nobody's it's like nobody's type of game, so it can be everybody's, because it's like heavy games, light games, medium games, Euro games, Ameritrash. Like, this is none of those things, so we can just all love it equally. It's kind of like Dolly Parton, right? It's like it's the great uniter. So yeah, Clask is my pick here. I feel like I play it all the time. Like, I'll be on phone calls and I'll just be like playing like tennis with the wall with my little class set over here. So it's great.
He's over there practicing while he's handling the phone call to the phone company or something like that. Yeah, it's interesting.
Oh, it's great. It's great because I can't let my 4-year-old beat me, because I'll never come back from that. She already beat me a Ticket to Ride First Journey the other day. I'm still not quite over it. But I'm also insanely proud that we finally played something like that next level, where I was like, oh wow, this is actually thoughtful and cool. So it's cool to watch your kids get to that age where they can start grokking at least like small rule sets like that.
So is this more of, you were saying like the Kensinki guys, you three guys have different levels of games you like. Are you generally more maybe there's like this light area of gaming? What's your general vibe for that?
I would say that most of my favorite games still skew medium heavy, like the heavier side of medium. But then I have like incredible like outliers in my top 10 games of all time. Like Quacks Quedlinburg is a top 10 of all time for me. I love that game. Just one. It's the perfect party game. I recently got to play River Valley Glassworks and Things and Rings, which are two of the upcoming all play releases. Excellent.
Heard very good things about both those. I can't wait to check them out.
Yeah, they're so good. I really like Dennis and I both very much identify as like omni gamers. Like, if it's a game, we're down to play it. With Dennis enjoying mean games more than I do. Like direct confrontation, more like American style games. Whereas I really do like more the Euro style, but kind of at all weight classes. I also play a lot solo, so I think that affects my preferences too. Because a lot of times I don't want to set up a... Exactly. It's like, if it's not solo, I can make it solo. So I think for me, it's like, I like the big heavy games, but it's like, I don't want to set them up for myself all the time. Like, I don't want to spend 45 minutes setting up a game for just me and then tear it back down. Though Alexander Pfister is my favorite designer, so I always make an exception for him. I'll spend an hour setting up, you know, Sky Mines or Great Western Trail or whatever, because he's the man. And he's like the one person on the Galactic Cruise bucket list who I think hasn't played it yet. We've had most of our other, like, we've had quite a few of our other, like, favorite designers play it by now. But we'll get him one day. Surely.
I am sure you will. Well, my instruments are going ham and crazy. They are seeing rocket ships take off behind them. So let's go ahead and dive into our story and hear Colton's experiences. Colton, we may not be in space, but we're in a place we know less about, which is the underwater world. So, take us away, guide us through this sea, tell us your story.
All right, so my story today is about my most memorable gaming experience. And that was back before my entire life seemed like it was consumed by Galactic Cruise, we would actually get together and play games just for fun sometimes.
Whoa.
And not worry about, you know, other things we were doing. So there for a while, it was myself, TK, his wife, and then her brother. We would get together and we were playing through Gloomhaven. And there was one scenario where I was exhausted, TK was exhausted, TK's wife Charity was exhausted. So basically it was just TK's brother-in-law fighting all the monsters off. And he was down to basically his last two cards, like his last duo of cards. After this turn, he would also be exhausted. We would lose the scenario. So he got himself into position with one card. Like, he was able to move into like a winning position. And I'm wanting to say he had to deal like 6 damage to whatever it was that he was facing off against. And he said, guys, my attack is for 3 damage. He said, the only way we win this is if I play this card, I flip this modifier, and I get the x2. He's like, you know, obviously if I get, you know, the critical miss, we die. If I get any negative or any, like, the +1 or the +2, we're dead. But if I get that x2, that'll give us the 6 hit points we need. So it was this very tense moment where, you know, he lays out the cards, like the monsters can really hear him, like he's like sneaking up on them, laying this card out. And he spent about 5 minutes flipping that modifier card over. And when he did, it was the x2. We dealt 6 damage. And we 4, all adult people, jumped up and started screaming like I don't think I've ever reacted like that before to anything. I'm fairly certain that we like shook the whole table and knocked everything off of it. Because it was just one of those like cool moments where it's like for a few minutes we were completely immersed in this game. And then when that happened, it's like we defeated the whatever it was. I can't remember what we were fighting. It's been that I think that was actually the last time we played Gloomhaven. Because I think it's like because like after that it's like TK moved houses and I moved houses. We still live fairly close to each other, but like we don't live as close, and mm-hmm. His brother-in-law like has a he doesn't live near us at all, so we were just playing when he was in town anyway. So it's one of those things, like it's almost like an exciting story with almost a sad ending where it's like, eh, we don't play Gloomhaven anymore. But I would love for us to all get back into it sometime, because that was such a memorable experience of just being just full force all the way into a game and winning on that last card, which feels so lucky, but at the time it felt so thematic and right and cool. Mm-hmm. So that's, as far as like memorable, like that's always the story I default on. So I call it my most memorable, because anytime anyone's like, you know, what was your best gaming experience? What was your most memorable? That's always the one that is burned in my mind, is us screaming like, I don't even know like what. I must have said like little girls, but it's like I teach 4th grade and I've heard little girls scream, and it was louder than that. Like it was much more frantic than that. Screaming like we'd never screamed before, knocked stuff off the table. It was something. We really thought that we had defeated some monsters instead of, you know, cardboard. And now I found out that even like Brass Birmingham can defeat Gloomhaven. So, you know, take that as you will.
Well, there's a couple things that are fun to unpack on that one, right? So obviously you're playing a campaign game and everybody was fully immersed in it, and that's great. But I think one of the things that makes this hobby different than other hobbies is that we throw obstacles in our own way. And the fun is overcoming those obstacles, right? So if the obstacle is too easy, it's not fun. If the obstacle is too hard, it's not fun. You got to find that sweet spot. And that sweet spot is getting down to the last card, or maybe the second to last card, or something close to that. But on top of that, when you get down to the last card and it feels like there's a 10% chance, or even less than 10% chance, in this case, it sounded like it was closer to 3 or 4%, then the overcoming of that adversity feels incredible. So it sounds a little bit almost like he did a little Babe Ruth and called the shot too. He kind of like pointed at the stands where he's going to put it out. And then he knocked it out that way. That's pretty cool also. So you add in all those things. And then I love this. While you're telling the story, I'm imagining it in my mind. Everybody jumps up from around the table. The table gets bumped. Everything is jostled. Everything falls away. You can't recreate that moment. You can't even reset up the game the same way. But it's almost like a table flip success instead of a table flip negative, which I think is really awesome. Great. That's very cool.
It was great.
So if you never open that box again, you are always going to have that memory of that moment, which I hope you do open the box again. I hope you move forward with the game and stuff like that. But I think that's also cool, because if you have a moment like that, then the cover of that box will always be a reminder of that moment, which means you get to revisit it over and over again when you see it on your shelf. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Super great moment. One that I will never forget for sure.
So here's the question then. Do you want to go back to Gloomhaven, even though there's a chance that you may have experience that could be rotten and ruin the game for you?
Ooh.
We had some rotten experiences. For sure. Like because we actually started on Jaws of the Lion, right? We were doing a 3-player Jaws of the Lion. And then when Charity's brother was like, hey, I may want to get into this thing, we started a big old Gloomhaven thing. But man, Jaws of the Lion, it was like scenario 4 or something. We played 8 times before but we got so close each time. It's kind of like what Andrew was talking about. It was too difficult, but we were so close each time that we're like, okay, we gotta reset. Let's do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I absolutely want to go back to Gloomhaven, though I'm going to be very tempted just to go digital with it, because you almost spend more time, especially with like Gloomhaven proper. Jaws of the Lion with the spiral book was a literal game changer. But with like full-on 22-pound Gloomhaven, I've heard the digital edition is excellent, and it plays out more, I think, like video gamey style from what I've seen. I've not really looked that much into it. It's definitely something I would like to get back into, possibly with a group on tabletop, or if nothing else, just one day if I ever have free time again, maybe just play through on my own. Because it really is a pretty incredible world that Isaac Childress invented. Because it's not like a derivative like D&D with a coat of paint on it. Like, he created like new races that do new things. And then even like, I think, innovated on races like when he came out with Frosthaven about like, yeah, or really, does being a race make you evil? And it was started this whole thing. They're like, how dare you say that a race, you know, could actually be more than one thing? And it was a whole big thing, but it's like, he really put some love and care into his world that I can appreciate. So it's a world that I would love to go revisit in some capacity sometime.
So looking at that, how do you tell, like, what instinct do you have when you can tell, when you're playing games? How do you know when a creator or designer has put that much love and effort into a game, even the small ones? How can you tell as a player or as a designer?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So kind of like the other arm of my life is in literature, in books. It's kind of the same way when you read a book or you watch a movie. It's like within the first 30 minutes of the movie or the first 50 pages of the book, you're like, I've read this story before slightly differently. It's like, oh, our main character is an orphan and he lives with his mean aunt and uncle, but there's something special about him. You're like, I bet he's going to meet a white-haired, bearded man who tells him he's special. And I bet he gets to go on an adventure. But I bet some evil thing has been reawoken and he'll have to defeat it through the power of friendship. And it's like that can be innovated upon. Like, that story can still surprise you. But sometimes Harry Potter and Luke Skywalker are the same person.
And Percy Jackson. Yeah.
Right. And Frodo, for that matter. Like,
sure.
And it's like all of those examples did it differently enough. It's then when you get the 10 copies of, you know, oh yeah, well, this is Henry Porter, and he lives in a different part of England, and he goes to a different magic school, that you're like, okay, this is not really the same thing. So I think for me in a game, it's when, and it doesn't even have to be much, because the weird thing in board games is like your selling point is sometimes your similarities to other games. It's like deck building is so useful, but you can't just remake Dominion step for step, or no one's going to latch onto it long term. People may like it in the short term because you got a cool theme pasted on it, but you still have to innovate on that thing. But at the same time, it's like, if you have deck building, you necessarily have to be like, okay, Dominion, you know, was the grandpappy of this, but here's how we're doing it differently. So I don't know. I think it's one of those unknowable, one of those like unpinpointable things, but it's a knowable thing. When you're playing a game or you're consuming any kind of media, books, movies, TV shows, whatever, where it's like there's a part where the path branches and you say, okay, this is the new thing. This is the thing that's getting me excited. This is the text message that says, what if you could build little buildings between the locations on the board and it could build out your work replacement instead of it just being a, oh, you took my spot. I guess I can't go there. And then the wheels start turning and things start changing.
I want to unpack that a little bit. There's some interesting things you've mentioned there. One, I think people who create know that we stand on the shoulders of giants, right? Like people mm-hmm. that came before us paved the trail that led up to this point. It's us. It's up to us to hack the underbrush and forge more trails past that, right? To keep moving forward, keep evolving, keep shifting. But I think one of the ways you can tell when something is given a lot of love is when the details are fleshed out, whether it be in, you know, literature where they create their own language for the species in this book, or they could pinpoint down to absurd details, which actually makes a difference in the story, or in games when they've focused so much on what they're doing that there are little hints and nuggets and callbacks or, you know, details that work their way into the storyline or the gameplay, and mm-hmm. it seamlessly integrates. I think we can intrinsically as humans pinpoint love based on detail. I feel like I can see it with artists when I'm looking at a great canvas and I can see it from far away and I can see that it's pretty or interesting or something like that. But when I get closer to it, when I spend time with it, I can notice the fine brush strokes and there's artistry within the details in that. And that's when I think it transcends. So I think details are what really showcase love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Totally agree.
Looking at this idea of details in a game, when do details go too far then? Because sometimes you hear reviewers say this game gets lost in the details or there's just too much going on. What line, where is the line between this detail makes this detail makes Star Wars, that we have this, the world building that George Lucas did, or we get the 1977 flop Laser Blast, which, you know, didn't have any details at all, or too many, like, well, where's the line? When is it too much or when is it too little? How do we find that sweet spot?
Man, that's an interesting question.
All right, I'm going to go first on this one. All right, so I think when I think you've gone too far is when you're starting to do a simulation of life rather than shave it down to the fun parts, right? I have played, unfortunately, some games, and I won't name the games, where I have to roll a die and then check a table to find out what the result is. And then that has to then modify another table, which then modifies a third table. Then I have to roll dice again on another table. And even though it may be true to life in the percentages and the chances of things, rolling dice and then doing math and then checking a grid and then rolling dice again on a fourth, you know, like, going too far down the rabbit hole means you've created something that has lost the fun. And I think part of the abstraction process of gaming is to infuse fun where there might not be fun. And so I think that you have to abstract things to make it more interesting. Otherwise, I could just go get a job at the butcher shop and butcher meat all day instead of making a game about how you can butcher the meat in a fun way.
And by the way, the game that he's referring to is Galactic Cruise from about 2 years ago. no, because we ran into this exact same problem. I call it a problem. It was a problem at the time. Now that we've overcome it, it was an obstacle, a learning experience. And that is, we wanted Galactic Cruise to be, or we really want all of our games we design to be highly thematic so that they are intuitive. Like, thematically intuitive is a word combination that we use a dozen times a day, every day. Thematically intuitive. But like Andrew was saying, like, that can go way too far where we were like, well, how would a ship actually launch? You know, how would you calculate the fuel for it? And there
doesn't
was
really like, matter.
At one point, no lie, there was like a full like PEMDAS order of operations thing to it. It's like, well, you take the amount of weeks you're traveling, plus the destinations that you're going to, multiplied by the guests, because you know the guests would add weight, and you would have to have more fuel. From if I were like, that's stupid. What if we just write the fuel cost on the cruise, and say that's how much it takes? And it's a long road getting there, because the other side of the coin is, you just make things cost whatever because it's fun, because it's mechanical, because players should be paying more for this, so we're just going to put a higher cost on it for no apparent reason. Finding that medium is key. I remember reading in, this is going to connect what we're talking about. It's going to sound like I'm off my rocker for a second. When I was in graduate school, I remember reading Moby Dick by Herman Melville. And there are throughout the book, I would say 200 pages total in the book that are just about like the science and history and minute details of whales that do not speed the plot at all. But it's like, he just really wants you to know everything there is about whales. So like on one hand, it's like, that's a novel that's about 30% too long, or if you want a personal opinion, about 100% too long. But it's like there's a good chunk of that book that did not have to be in there. But on the other hand, it's like you don't need an encyclopedia. You don't need any kind of reference book. Herman Melville has told you everything you'll ever need to know about sperm whales and the processing of them and the history of them. And it's all something. It's all in there for you. And for whatever reason, that book still gets read nowadays. And I will say, like, I'm going to give Herman some merit here. Like, he was very knowledgeable and he did a great job, I guess, putting it on paper. And I went to school with people who loved him very much and thought that it was just the best thing. It was just a little too much for me. I did not need to know that much about whales and how to process them or whatever. But it worked. And sometimes it does work. I think that's also what complicates this thing, is sometimes there are games that have, you know, a flow chart that leads to a grid that leads to another flow chart, and people love it and it gets rave reviews. And then other designers say, well, I need to do that because that game did so well, which, you know, you all are both game designers, and that's something that I think we have to fight, or if not fight, reckon with. Right, that what causes one person's success is not a guaranteed success for you. And that's what makes things tricky. But yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. Like when it moves from game to simulation on the tabletop, that's when it gets too far.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things to unpack that I want to talk about. One of them is replication is not ideal success, because one, you're only looking at the top of the iceberg, right? You're seeing the 1%, and you don't get to see the 99% of sweat and effort and tweaking and evolution that game took place to get mm-hmm. to. So if you try to replicate it, that's a good starting point, but you're starting off at 5%, not at 95% when you replicate. Right. So you almost have to redesign it after that. But I'm in favor of people being inspired by things they like or inspired by things that are successful. Go ahead and make that a starting point. Be that a place where you want to go and then test from there, and mm-hmm. it will find its own life whether you like it or not.
Well, we've talked about details, so now we're in a interesting place where we can see almost every single detail in this tabletop. See, it's a wonderful thing. So let's go ahead and turn on our sonar, wrap up this segment, and talk about what games we're looking forward to in the future. Yeah, but Colton casually dumping on the first great American novel.
Listen, I have very strong feelings about American
if he had
literature.
Paused for a second longer, I would have said that's the best book since sliced whale, and that would have been a good little pun. But it didn't. I just anyway.
Listen,
it's okay.
There's an entire section on the extraction of the sperm. I'm like, I don't need to know how to do that.
Thanks anyway. Oh, good old Herman. Herman doing his
old
best.
Hermy.
Oh, Hermy.
He did just fine. Don't worry about him. All right, let's move on.
In the sonar, on the sonar, we talk about one game we're looking forward to playing in the future and why we're looking forward to playing it. So, Colton, what is your white whale you're chasing after currently?
Ooh.
Well, listen, done. You know me and those white whales. I love to love to chase them. So the game that I am most looking forward to at this very moment, this could change in later tonight or tomorrow, but right now it is Ezra and Nehemiah coming out from Garfield Games. So for me, like as far as like game designers go, Alexander Pfister sits on top of the pyramid, but like right below him is Shim Phillips and S.J. McDonald. So this is one of their collaborations that got kickstarted last year. It is due to arrive sometime soonish. I think in Shim's last update, he said that manufacturing is finished up, and really it's more of a waiting game for Chinese New Year to like get the games on boats. But they really have made a reputation for themselves of like running a Kickstarter, and like as soon as I think funds come in, they are going to production. They don't do like stretch goals. The game is done when it goes, which is actually a model that we were trying to emulate in our company. This idea of like actually getting a game out. So it's exciting when you back a Garfield game. You know that you're actually going to get a Garfield game before you forget about it. But I'm really looking forward to this one. I think it's a neat theme. You know, this idea of, you know, like the returning exiles rebuilding the walls and temples in Jerusalem. I think the artwork really works nicely here. It's done by Sam Phillips, Shim's brother. So this one is actually not done by the Micho like some of their other games are, but this is like part of their ancient anthology. And it's been described as kind of like a greatest hits album of like what Shim and SJ do best. And what they do best is make games that reach my top 20, top 10, top 5. So I'm really looking forward to this one.
I had a chance to play this at Mega Moose Con last year. And yes. I had the chance.
Oh.
I didn't get to play it. Because my car blew up on the way up there, and I brought my whole family with me. And Will Meadows, I was talking with him, and I saw like I told him I really want to play that one. He's like, "Well, I have an extra spot open. Do you want to play?" I was like, "No, I can't because my mom's gonna pick me up in 20 minutes." I felt like such a kid. I was like, "My mom's picking me up because my car blew up. I got to take my wife and kids home." So. I mean, it looked so great. I got to see the whole spread on the table. He let me look at it. So this is one I'm definitely interested in because of the theme. But also, I mean, like, I've enjoyed the Shem Phillips games and games I played in that kind of genre and stuff. So good choice. I'm looking for this one as well. Andrew, you're talking about a game about ice cream, correct?
No, I'm talking about The Great Split. So this is ice cream. I split, you choose game with tracks. So essentially, you get a handful of cards, and apparently you get to choose which cards go in which stack, and then you pass the stacks, and then the person picks one of those and passes back the stuff they don't want to you, and then you get to score that stuff. I have not tried this yet, but I know this has been a popular game. People seem to like it quite a bit. It has a cool Art Deco-y kind of vibe to it. It's about rich people acting badly. So, you know, it's akin to Obsession, but not. So that's what I'm looking forward to is The Great Split.
So what's the theme in this?
It's I pick, you choose, basically. And or I split, you choose.
Okay, hold on a hot minute. Once the great split.
The Great Split, yes.
Okay, it's a very pretty game. It's got a remarkable cover.
It's Art Deco-y, yeah.
Yeah.
Literally, it's just...
It's right rich here. People. And
in the Great Split, you draft cards to collect riches. Gems, gold, artwork, and tone. This is almost worse than the My City thematic explanation. Oh my goodness, just don't. Sorry. It's an abstract
with artwork painted on top. That's what it is.
But hey, exactly, you get to pass a wallet, and that's pretty cool. That's a neat, a component hook is that you do like split them in a wallet, and someone takes out like half the wallet.
See, I mean, I can respect this a lot. Like, have you ever played My City, Colton?
I've played the, it's like the backside of the, it's like the one-off, whatever. Because TK and Charity played like the whole Legacy campaign and then like brought it over, and I just played like the one-off of it.
Okay.
So, no, I've not, I'm not going to say that I've played it though, because I've not really played it. I've not played like the Legacy experience there.
So the thematic explanation for My City is you arrive in a new land. It's like two sentences where it's like you arrive in a new land and there's so much to build and you start to build. My City is like an abstract. It goes straight into like, yeah, okay, there's your two sentences of theme. You're laying polyominoes on the ground. And this is the same thing. It's like in the Great Split, you draft cards to collect riches. And you earn prestige points. Like, it's not even pretending like it's theme, which I can respect that. I'd rather a game be like, hey, yeah, here's a little bit of Salt Bay sprinkled with some of the the theme on there, but it's not the Mac game you're playing game. So I can respect that choice, Andrew. It's following the good steps of the great Dr. Knizia.
All right, Josh, what are you looking forward to?
So I was able to get a copy of Underwater Cities into my collection because my friend was clearing out some space. He's like, who wants these games for free? And I was like, I will take Underwater Cities and Monza.
It's a good one.
Two very different games. I'm trying to expand more. I always try to expand my horizons, and I don't get to play too many of these type of like, you know, Terraforming Mars, Underwater Cities type games. And the theme of Underwater Cities appeals to me a little bit more in lots of ways. So like, you know what? I'm going to try it. It's sitting on my shelf. It literally is just going to involve me sitting down and reading a rule book. And just, it looks pretty self-explanatory. But I'm just excited to play because I've heard such great things about it. And it might actually, if I like it enough, I might actually play Terraforming Mars. Like, I have a video game version of Terraforming Mars I just never played because of just lack of interest. I got in a giant Humble Bundle collection. But if I like Underwater Cities enough, I might make the jump over to see if I like the good old Frix game, the only Frix game out there. So, but that's Underwater Cities.
Colton, imagine a captain of a submarine being interested in a game called Underwater Cities. It shocks. It's really shocking.
Listen, I am shocked, appalled. I'm actually over here wondering now, do I not have it saved? Talking about Terraforming Mars and Underwater Cities, I'm wondering which of those I rank higher. I think probably Underwater Cities. That's interesting, though.
I've played it more recently,
for sure.
Yeah, it's one of those things where people always compare the two. And... Mm-hmm. But from the people who I trust and know, they say there's really not much the same, except you're just building things. So I mean,
there's the card tableau. There is like, because Underwater Cities is kind of worker placement. I mean, it is worker placement. It just doesn't, like, when I think of worker placement games, I don't think of Underwater Cities. But yeah, it's got a good, it's got some neat mechanics to it.
I mean, it's engine building and it's tableau, so that's as close as I think you get with the two comparison. I think they are both about the same weight as far as that goes, but Suchi does interesting things. I'm a big fan of Praga Kaput Regni over that one, for me personally.
Me too.
I think that one does more interesting things of his, but you know, I would definitely say you should probably play all of them.
Good to know. I've actually never played a Vladimir Suchi game, so I'm excited to jump into that as well.
Okay.
Well, we've been down here long enough. We're starting to see all the white whales. We see the tombstone of Herman Melville being spat upon. We're going to shoot up to the surface, and we're going to let Colton go. Colton, thank you so much for giving me some of your time today to come on with us on a small little adventure and talk about Gloomhaven and literature and all sorts of things. If people want to support you or Kintsinki or Galactic Cruise, what can they do? They want more Colton in their life. What can they do?
Absolutely. Yeah, so we are on Facebook. We have a Kintsinki Games Facebook page, as well as a Galactic Cruise board game Facebook group. We have a Kintsinki Games Discord server. We are at Kintsinki Games on Instagram. And then you can find Galactic Cruise on BoardGameGeek. And yeah, and then I'm the only Koltin Thompson that I'm aware of. So if you want to find me, that's much less interesting, but I am around. So, you know, find me, I guess. You can see pictures of my kids and my dogs sometimes. Occasionally game stuff.
See, he is a real person.
I am a real person, allegedly.
And if you want to send any complaints about his dissertation or his view on Herman Melville's books, you can send it to moby@dick.com.
Google that, children. Well,
well, thank you so much again, Colton. As always, my name is Josh.
I'm Andrew, and...
Who, is it me?
See, I'm Colton.
I'm Colton. I'm Ron Burgundy.
And this has been your and this has been Tabletop. We need to get better at that. We don't give any guests forewarning about this ending.
We really should. This... Okay, let's try it again. Let's do an edit here.
No,
and do a cut.
We're not gonna edit. I'm gonna leave this whole part in to show what great hosts we are.
Oh god.
And this has been the Tabletop Summary.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to support the Tabletop Summary podcast, please consider giving us 5 stars on iTunes and share this podcast with your friends, family, and other gamers in your life. See you on the next voyage.